Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching and reading and listening to. On this week's show, we're talking about the delicious and the distasteful in the world of food in culture. We'll talk about competition cooking shows, luscious portrayals of chowing down, and lots more. Then we'll go back to school for a talk about college, how portrayals get it right and wrong, and maybe a little of what we learned ourselves. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening. Wherever you spend your mornings, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story is, Morning Edition connects you to it. So listen to the show on the radio every weekday morning. Find your local station schedule at npr.org.
Well, we've got the basics of food and school on the schedule today, but before we get to that, let's go around the table here in Studio 44. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Directly to my right is Stephen Thompson. Stephen, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
Well, this is one of our very special weeks that we enjoy the most when we are joined by our pals from Code Switch. Kat Chow, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a blogger and social media producer for Code Switch.
And Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a blogger and correspondent for Code Switch.
Well, it's always such a treat when we have you guys in the studio, especially together.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I mean, it's good to be here with you guys. With Caitlin Chow.
Oh, yeah, our favorite brother and sister
That's right.
Brought out the full name.
Warring forever. So the first thing on our agenda this week, we want to talk a little bit about food in culture. Now, this topic is potentially very broad. So the first thing that I want to do is I want to address myself to Stephen and his love of certain cooking shows.
Sure.
Stephen, talk to me about the competition cooking shows that are your particular jam.
That are staples of my, I don't want to say diet.
Yeah,
but
you
I watch an extraordinary amount of cooking shows for somebody who cannot cook at all.
Yeah, and that's partly because you have a young person in your house who's into the cooking shows.
Yeah, I mean, both my kids like them, but my son, who's 14, watches them obsessively and has actually taken an interest in cooking, I think. And it's been fascinating because I expected there to be a certain amount of interest in your Cutthroat Kitchen, in your Top Chef, in your Master Chef, and particularly Master Chef Junior, which we've discussed on the show before, because those fall into the category of elimination-based reality shows, which it's human behavior and cooking and sports kind of all rolled into one. But what's been interesting is seeing my kids develop a fairly obsessive interest in the show Good Eats with Alton Brown. First of all, they love Alton Brown. They love Alton Brown from Cutthroat Kitchen. Mm-hmm. They love Alton Brown from the fact that Alton Brown is really fun. Good Eats is a Peabody Award-winning program in which Alton Brown discusses the history and scope with a certain amount of depth of like each individual food item. And, you know, to see like your 11-year-old sitting there watching him talk about margaritas. I mean, that in and of itself is one of the interesting things about cooking shows, I think, which is that they're aspirational. And so my 11-year-old is sitting there aspiring to one day, hopefully in the very distant future, enjoy the great taste of a margarita.
Gene, do you watch cooking television?
The cooking television that comes across my field of vision comes from my girlfriend. So it's a lot of Top Chef. Can I just complain about this a little bit?
Not
complain, really. It's
no,
more like, it is like watching, if there was a show called like Top Olfactory Chemist, and then, and they were like, put an eyedropper onto a tissue, and like, and someone held it up like, this smells very much like a burger. Like, you can't, like, there's a whole sensorial relationship to this thing that they're creating that you cannot access.
So you're only accessing it visually. You have to imagine.
Right, you see like some ahi tuna and it's like cut very like very finely.
So that's
finely.
Like any cooking show.
Yeah, it's just like you, people are being judged and you're like, I have no idea what they're doing anymore.
Right, and I think that is, I think that was a frequently mentioned difference between that show and Project Runway, which was its kind of clearest ancestor.
Sure, or even a show like Idol where you're like, you can actually, like,
you can judge the singing.
You can have your own opinion of the singing or of the dress, but it's hard to have your own opinion of the food. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about Top Chef is that that show is so judge dependent. I tend to like Top Chef because I like the judges and because they are good at describing and conveying what the food is like to eat and because I trust them. When Tom Colicchio, who is a judge on that show, explains what food is like to eat, I believe him. So when he says, this food is really bland, I tend to believe him. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why they've benefited sometimes from having, like, when Anthony Bourdain was on that show briefly, all too briefly, in my opinion.
Yeah, agreed.
It was great because he would congratulate them on when the food was good. And when the food was not good, it was a lot of fun to hear him say pretty plainly mm-hmm. what it was like to eat. How about you, Kat? Are you a food show person?
No, I love watching food shows and also HGTV. So anything between HGTV and Food Network, that's my jam. That's a good segue into talking about how much I love Chopped for that very reason, because I don't know what these things taste like. And I don't really want to know what three crazy basket ingredients
taste
like
exactly.
together. And so for me, it's all about the creativity.
Right.
In the kitchen, I'm not that type of person who's going to take a radish and add it to
anything.
Yeah. And so it's always like having a blank canvas.
I think one of the reasons people really love Chopped is that it has more in common with the way people cook in their houses than a lot of these other shows do.
Yeah.
I mean, you're probably not going to sit there and have to figure out, like, what am I going to do with fish and cherry soda? Like, that's probably not going to happen.
All I have is marmalade and licorice.
But I will say, it does, over time, you learn how different things function in recipes by how people use them.
Exactly.
It's like when people say, like, well, I got this and it's sweet, so I need something that's acidic or salty to kind of cut how sweet it is. When people are forced to use not the most obvious ingredients, you see how they adapt them. And that's why I think Chopped actually is probably the show that improves my cooking the most.
Right. And actually, so I grew up in a household. I've told Gene a lot about my dad. My dad in the kitchen. I love him. Bless his heart. But he would always come up with really interesting food combinations. And he's of the very waste not. That's where it always comes from, like figuring out how to use this spoiled ingredient, for example. Chopped had a recent episode that was just all ingredients that were getting really stinky. And that made me think of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, nothing dangerous, obviously, but things that are kind of starting to turn. They not infrequently work with food that either is leftovers or is somehow otherwise something that people would often like not eat.
Yeah.
Like sometimes they'll do like, oh, it's the heels of bread and, you know, pieces that they would expect to be thrown out. So I think Chopped has some actual everyday applications. But it's interesting to question because Gene raised this issue of how hard it is to convey the taste of food without being able to taste it yourself. There is a tradition, though, of certainly movies that are very dependent on making you appreciate kind of this meal is wonderful or this thing is wonderful. I mean, there's like Big Night, which is about the Italian restaurant. That is an older movie for those of you who are younger to the show.
How about Ratatouille for the benefit of
Ratatouille would be
or Lunchbox.
Oh, The Lunchbox is such a good movie. Incidentally,
I love that movie. Oh.
I've talked about that movie a few times. If you still have not seen The Lunchbox, which is an Indian film from a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And that's a great one for like the food in that movie is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. It's about the system in India in which mostly men go to work. And while they're at work, their lunches are delivered by guys who bring them from home. And they come and bring you your lunch. And they have this elaborate system of dropping off the right lunchbox with the right person. And it's about this man who starts getting the wrong lunchboxes. And he gets this wonderful food and ultimately meets the woman who's been making it. And it's a very, very sweet story.
It's a lovely, lovely movie.
It is. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite food movie or show, Jane?
I don't have a favorite. I think the movie that I saw most recently that sticks like into my head, and not because it was great by any means, but was Chef, the Jon Favreau movie.
Oh, yeah. That was so good.
The movie's sort of about this chef. Jon Favreau's in it. John Leguizamo's in it. Sofia Vergara's in it, who is sort of trying to get to this authentic thing. And so the movie is basically the central character in the movie, besides those people I named, is like the Cuban sandwich. And it's a really lovely movie, but also like it's one of those movies you leave like, I need to eat something. Like it's very, it makes you very, very hungry. You always remember how sort of visceral, like we eat so functionally, like we're just like, oh, let me just go grab something to eat. Like how much of the process of actually slaving over something. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a movie that captured how much fun it is to anticipate something being done,
like
the finishing of cooking something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, food is like the definition of a universal experience, mm-hmm. right? Like, we all have to eat. And so when it is done in a way that entails artistry, that artistry can be appreciated by a broader spectrum of people
sure.
than might appreciate other forms of art.
Right.
You know, you talk about, like, what's your favorite food movie? Like, I'm a real sucker for Ratatouille, which is, you know, part of it is a warm and magical Disney Pixar, you know, adventure. But it's also wrapped around this very populist message
sure.
of, like, anybody can make art. It's just kind of this very basic idea that, like, art can come from the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so that movie is very much about soul.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I am not a great chef, I don't necessarily aspire to be a great chef. The best I can sort of aspire to is proficiency. It's still something where I can look at it from afar and admire it swooningly.
Sure.
Yeah. And I think there does continue to be a, as you said earlier, an aspirational quality to a lot of food television and food movies because, as I said, Chopped has often kind of put my head in the space of thinking about creativity and inventiveness and stuff like that. But there are also shows, and even shows like Hell's Kitchen, which I consider the kind of least good cooking-oriented
right.
show
yeah.
in that...
But the most yelling-oriented.
Right. Well, and I think it was the very first, possibly the very first episode of this podcast ever, may have been the one when we talked about the fact that Top Chef is a show about people who are really, really good at cooking, and Hell's Kitchen is a show about people who smoke. And Hell's Kitchen
yes.
is a show very often about people who are screwing up. But even on a show like Hell's Kitchen, you learn about stuff like, that's why I know basically what those Gordon Ramsay beef Wellingtons mm-hmm. look like, which are these pieces of beef and they're wrapped in pastry, but there's like a mushroom paste that goes around the meat before it gets put in the pastry. And I was reading something recently that explained that the reason why you do that is so that the juice from the meat doesn't sogify
the pastry.
Sure. So you put this barrier of this like mushroom duxelle around the meat. Even on Hell's Kitchen, there are things I have learned, like how short you cook scallops.
Oh, yeah.
Like how quickly you sear scallops.
Yeah.
That all comes from Hell's Kitchen.
But there's, I mean, I remember hearing some wives' tale about like how there was some restaurant in New York City that the thing they made you do if you wanted to be like a sous chef there or just work there was to make an omelet and how hard that is to do. Apparently, there are like things that everyone, I've made like an omelet once and I thought it was like, yes.
Yeah. Well, like,
I graduated to the level of omelet making. It was only once.
Jiro Dreams of Sushi, there's this storyline with a father and a son who are at a sushi restaurant or own one. I think the son, his one job for 10 years, is to make, is it tamago, the egg sushi? He has to make the egg in one of the flat pans and be able to flip it just the perfect way.
Mm.
And he's so frustrated because his dad is getting older and he's been doing this job for 10 years and he really wants to move up and, I don't know, like start slicing the fish or something. And I mean, which is really hard. I don't want to like make light of that, but that documentary is one that really blew my mind.
And one of the scenes that I was thinking about, if I can say, one of the scenes that I was thinking about in a movie when we talked about this topic was the scene in Bridesmaids in which Kristen Wiig makes a cupcake for herself. And it is this scene in which you can see that the experience of making it, she's very sad when she does this, and the experience of making it is very healing for her. The experience of making it really makes her feel better. The whipping and the mixing and the frosting and the, you know, making this beautiful, beautiful thing. And then she sits there and eats the cupcake. And when she eats the cupcake by herself, that's unhappy. It's funny, but it's this really profound idea
yeah.
about how the making of something is a wonderful thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then the having nobody to give it to
yeah.
is a really sad
it's like
thing.
Her eating that cupcake by herself is like her version of the shower cry, you know?
It's like, Kat, you've been tweeting about the shower cry.
I know.
Steven's we should
like,
talk.
We need to talk. But seriously, like, this is why when I make stuff, I greatly prefer if there's somebody that I
yeah.
can give part of it to
sure.
because it's not as fun to be like, it's for myself. You have to be willing to do good things for yourself and all that.
That's what
true.
I say. Let's talk about this.
I know, right? It's like an element of self-care. And that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not how she is feeling when she eats that cupcake. Like,
yeah,
she feels
yeah.
like she doesn't have anyone to give this beautiful thing to. It's actually quite touching in this certain way.
I mean, that is another way that cooking is like art. you know, the difference between the craftsmanship and viewing it as a consumer. You know, we've talked about all these different food shows, and one of the first things that popped into my head was not a cooking show at all, but an eating show. The Fox's 2002 Glutton Bowl.
Oh, God.
Which is one of my favorite hours of programming of all time.
Yes. So how does Glutton Bowl work?
Yeah, what is this show?
And part of it, and maybe part of this is the shared experience of I was at work late when a friend called to ask me to turn on the TV and watch this with him.
Yeah, and I will say, before Stephen explains what this is, you should know that when Stephen and I were first becoming friends, he sent me a DVD in the snail mail of Glutton Bowl.
Wow.
So
oh,
I could see it. That's how much it means to him.
It was etched into the firmament.
It's competitive eating.
It's the IFOCE, the International Federation of Competitive Eating, put together this program, which part of what I love about this show, it was a two-hour special in primetime on Fox. They aired it opposite the figure skating competition in the Winter Olympics.
Oh, my gosh.
And so they clearly, somebody at Fox decided, like, what is the most un-figure skating thing we could put on.
Give that person a medal.
It was so smart. I would give that person a medal. They have your typical announcer guy, and then you have the more smooth-talking analyst guy. And then there's the announcer who, near the beginning of the show, gets to intone the words, 5,000 hard-boiled eggs. And then a gigantic machine drops 5,000 hard-boiled eggs into a large, like, net.
So aside from the profound waste
right.
and weirdness
right.
of this, what fascinated you about Glutton Bowl?
I think how there's decadent, like, look at that beautiful chocolate dessert. Mm-hmm. And then there's just watching people shove eggs into their mouths.
Oh, eggs, though. That's so,
that's so
heavy. The stick of butter one.
Yeah, they ramp it up. There's one where it's bowls of mayonnaise. And part of it, there's a little bit of a Fear Factor clown show.
A little bit.
Quality
sounds
to it.
Like it.
But then there's also, I mean, this was during the height of Takaru Kobayashi, the legendary kind of Hall of Fame competitive eater, who was eventually dethroned by a superior hot dog eater in Joey Chestnut. I just enjoyed having this be a thing that I liked. I think just deciding that was going to be an element of my personality was that I was somebody who liked watching people.
Well, I'm glad that we've managed to incorporate some competition shows, some really beautiful things like the sushi documentary that Kat was mentioning, and competitive eating.
That's right.
So we've kind of we've made a nice tour of this kind of thing.
We've not made a tour of Kat Chow's college newspaper column, Chow Time.
Okay, Chow Time. So everyone calm down. It started.
How was it not called Chow Down?
Well,
Chow Time is just as good.
Chow Time felt like it was more about me, you know? Because I was like, I'm going to be the daily of the University of Washington's food reviewer. Every single week, I would go review a different restaurant in the neighborhood. But I would do my sign off as, and I'm Kat. Ciao. Oh, well, I've been waiting to do that for NPR.
Wow. Oh, my God.
This is a big day for you.
This is a big day for all of us.
Yeah. Maybe I can sign off Pop Culture Happy Hour with that.
This is one of my favorite things that's ever happened on the show that I wasn't expecting.
Yes. This is one of the great things about having somebody on who's a lot closer to college age is that your embarrassing college memories are like 3 years ago.
They're still there. Yeah.
It's true. Well, that's fantastic. And I cannot think of a better segue into our next topic, which when we come back, we're going to talk about college, not just Kat and her newspaper column and television show that we just found out about, but some other things as well, portrayals of college, our time in college, and things we've learned about college, perhaps from pop culture. So stick around.
Hi, I'm Shannon Dodson, and I'm calling from Long Beach, Mississippi. NPR is supported by Target. With the Made to Matter collection, handpicked by Target, brands like Annie's, Method, Seventh Generation, Happy Baby, and more are just an aisle away. The Made to Matter collection is available to explore in store or online at target.com/made-to-matter.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. You might remember that we were talking just a moment ago about the fact that when our friend Kat Chow was in college, she had a column called Chow Time, which was about food, naturally. So speaking of college, This is the other thing we were going to talk about today. Now, I just recently, while I was at the Tribeca Film Festival, I saw a documentary about the National Lampoon, the magazine, and they spoke about how that brand spun off into various films, perhaps most famously, Animal House. So college obviously comes with a variety of cultural and pop cultural portrayals, one of which is Animal House, but there are others as well. So we thought we would talk a little bit about that. So, Kat, we did not all have newspaper columns and TV shows as you did.
Yeah.
But we all had a college experience. Do you have thoughts, as probably our person who was most recently a collegian? What did this kick off in your mind?
Yeah, well, as you might know from the New Year's episode, I've been binge-watching Parenthood, and I'm still binge-watching it because that show is never-ending.
It's true. There's
it's
a lot
April,
of it.
And I still have yet to finish. I think that show has been the most recent pop culture force that's covered college. So you have Hattie, who goes to Cornell, and she goes through all these issues where they might not be able to afford college or not. And then there's another brother who goes to a college in the area. And there's a daughter who just decides not to go. And so you have all of these different perspectives of the family members who are in and out of their stages.
Right,
and their,
sure.
Their adolescence.
So let me ask you this.
All right.
When they actually get around to portraying college, does it look anything like college?
I think that these kids were much cooler than I was in college.
because very often one of the things that I find is that college is the things going on. And I mean, obviously, I had a very specific experience. I had a small liberal arts school experience. Mm-hmm. But it was not quite as zooey
sure.
as college
right.
always is on television and in movies.
And I think that, I mean, so my college experience was pretty nerdy. I lived on the honors floor at my university. And so everyone was just always studying, and there was no drinking because scared freshmen were a little too afraid, or at least the crowd that I hung out with at first. And so, like, watching all of these things about these cooler kids, or even, like, these cooler nerdy kids having these experiences, a part of me is like, man, I gotta watch some pop culture-y things that show, like, the really, truly squarish college kids. That makes me seem really unfun, but...
No, that's fair. How about you, Gene? What are you thinking?
It's funny because there's all these movies about college when I was in high school and in college that never seemed to get. I went to like a medium-sized private college outside of New York City on Long Island. And it was not, like you said, it wasn't very zooey. The thing I always notice now when I watch anything talking about college is sort of the dread around sort of college acceptance. A good example of this is like Friday Night Lights, right? Where like the thing that was always looming in the background was like whether or not they were going to get out, right?
Sure.
Like,
yeah,
and that's
yeah,
the thing
yeah.
I always sort of felt. But like whether or not they were going to go to college, because like
right.
not getting into college or getting into college was like was going to be the thing that decided the way the rest of
well,
the
lives right. and that college is this gateway between failure and success.
Absolutely. And just like, I mean, there's the episode with Tyra, which I won't ruin for you, but you will cry. The episode with Tyra, where she writes her college acceptance mm-hmm. or her college admissions letter, and it's really heartfelt about like what it means for her to go to college. But when you get to college, it's actually not. It wasn't for me. I mean, I know you went to like a huge state school,
yeah.
And it was probably like people having bonfires every day. And no. Whenever you watch movies about big colleges or whatever, it always seems like there's this thing happening elsewhere in the country that I was not privy to. We didn't have a big football team. We didn't have any of that stuff.
I think that, you know, we're talking about these different college experiences, and Lindo going to a small liberal arts school, you went to a medium school, Kat, you went to a big state school, mm-hmm. you went to University of Washington.
Yes, I did.
And so I had kind of a little bit of a similar, I went to University of Wisconsin at Madison. And I think that as much as we're talking about the different experiences from college to college, I think you get to a big enough school, and I'm assuming this is true of small schools as well, where that range of experience is just as wide.
Mm-hmm.
Within a school as it is from school to school, or almost
right.
between college and graduating from high school and going out and living your life.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, there are all these cultural signposts that come up in college of, you know, like your first frat party mm-hmm. and your first, you know, blah, 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 that college is set up as this series of firsts. And I think that within the experience at an individual college, that range is massive. I think I mentioned on the show recently that whole thing about how, you know, if your school is named like America's number one party school, the first thing I do is like, I wasn't invited to any of them.
Where was I?
Yeah, there are these things that are intrinsically different from school to school that affect particularly how close your college experience comes to what you see portrayed.
Sure,
for
yeah.
example,
yeah, exactly.
My college had no Greek life at all.
At all.
There's no Greek anything.
Whoa.
Like in the traditional sense of what that means to have fraternities and sororities on your campus.
Sure.
You know, ones that have their own houses and stuff like that. Just did not have it
at all.
Wow.
So when I look at kind of the idea of fraternities and fraternity parties and sororities and sorority stuff, it's like reading about a country I never visited. It's like I take their word for it, but it comes very much out of things I just wasn't part of.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even like when I watch a college football game for like a SEC school and you see like 75,000 people at a stadium, like that scale is impossible to wrap my mind around because my school was so much smaller, right? I mean, you went to a Big Ten school.
Yeah.
And so you would have had this big, like everyone would have trucking in on a Saturday to go see the Badgers, but like I can't imagine what that would have been like. And like whenever you see college portrayals, you very rarely see like small liberal arts schools in movies or in TV, but you do see sort of like state.
I completely immersed myself in a few extracurricular activities.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The college radio station and the college newspaper, which I joined The Onion when I was a junior in college. Nice. So anything that is a depiction of what it is like to work for a college newspaper, mm-hmm. which is one reason I had such a viscerally frustrated reaction to all that stuff in Dear White People about the satirical magazine being like a bunch of fratty bullies, which was just, we were just a bunch of nerds. Like that's who writes for the people who write for the campus satirical magazine are not the cool kids.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, that's how I relate to college entirely is through college radio and college newspapers. And so, like, when I was thinking about this topic, it was just coming to things that rang true or false based on college radio, college newspaper. So like a movie like Pump Up the Volume, where like the FCC comes and like hauls him away in chains. I actually took a phone call from the FCC shutting down my college radio station. It was not like that at all.
They just kind of called and said,
could you stop? And then, you know, and then it took 8.5 years to build a new station.
Wait, why did you?
What happened with that?
We were very low power. We were 1.5 watts. And so, like, you could hear our station on one side of the dorm floor, but you couldn't hear it if you were, like, across the hall. And so, you know, eventually somebody, it interfered with somebody's ham radio signal. So we got shut down.
Wow.
Man. Yeah. Just in listening to you guys talk, I think that one thing that all of these TV shows and movies that always talk about college cover are the dorm situation.
Yeah.
So your roommates, the interpersonal dynamics where you're kind of just wedged in with someone for the very first times. And I will say that there is something to be said about shows like Parenthood, for example, that have those dynamics and how real or not real they are. I think probably going around, each of you have had college roommates at some point, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a gold mine of TV and movie fodder.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because it is a natural setting for mismatched pairs.
Right,
yeah. Absolutely.
And so it's a natural setting for meet-cute situations and kind of buddy situations and bad roommate situations. It's such ripe fodder. It's almost like these animated movies where they kill the parents.
Right.
Like, college is kind of a less gory and traumatic way to separate someone from their family and suddenly have somebody who has agency for the first time.
Right. And when you talk about some of this stuff, it brings up for me another thing from this National Lampoon documentary that I was watching, which is this interview with Chevy Chase in which he says essentially, you know how when you're 20, you think every opportunity in the world belongs to you and like you can do anything. Every opportunity is open to you. Mm. And I sat there and I thought, not everyone feels that way when they're 20, but he did.
Right.
And so I think there is a way that people romanticize college as this moment, particularly if you come into college with a lot of advantages and very low consequences for failing. People come in with this kind of like, I'm the king of the world. Yeah. And you see, the National Lampoon documentary is a good example of how like having that attitude can be very adaptive. Like you can be very successful based on having that attitude, based on being like, if I go and ask a bunch of rich people for money, they will give it to me.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that is a very empowering thing. And there are people who really romanticize college the moment that your ability to go conquer the world comes into existence.
Sure. Right. One of the things about the outsized sort of a profile of college in our pop culture, like, I mean, like, it's just on MTV and, like, everywhere, is that, like, close to 70% of people in the United States like don't go to college or don't grad. I mean, the number of people in the United States who have college degrees is like, what, in the high 20s?
Yeah, or 30s. Even bachelor's versus...
Right, exactly.
Like, associates.
But that is very, like on TV, it looks like normative, right? It looks like a big thing that everyone does, right? Yeah. It's that weird thing we talk about all the time about like, how our pop cultural space is also like a place without class. Like everyone is just, everyone is just sort of upper middle class, although no one says that. It is, it's funny, really funny that you say that just because it is like a reminder of how much that is, it looks like... That's the experience that everyone is having. But of course, most people in this country have no experience with a college campus.
That's such a great point. It reminds me of something that Linda said once in a completely different setting where you said, history isn't written by the winners, it's written by the writers.
It isn't.
And I think it's one of the smartest things you've ever said.
But
that's where you get that. Generally, TV writers, especially that whole Ivy League channel where people go from Ivy League universities into TV writing, and is going to massively skew not only the stories that TV tells, but the stories of college that TV tells. Yeah. Is because the because so many, like how many Simpsons writers were at Harvard that they make jokes about it on the show. And so you get a very skewed view of, yeah, like you said, how many people even go to college, but also what those experiences are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. And it's no wonder that people who were at the National Lampoon would have envisioned Animal House. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of a time of all parties and no stakes. And that whole vision of college as your great moment of stakes-free exploration of self is not something that everyone has the luxury of doing. Like, one of my friends in college graduated in 3 years in a very, very demanding program in neuroscience, which had more required hours than any other major. And people would sometimes say, like, why are you trying to graduate in 3 years? And it would take a long time for people to get to, that way I only have to pay for 3 years
for college.
Right. That way low money.
And it would be like, well, that's a good reason that a lot of people coming in as 18-year-olds don't immediately go to. Wouldn't it be great to buy 3 years of college instead of four? That may not occur to you.
Yeah.
I think this is all very interesting stuff, and I would be interested to hear what folks have to say, so I hope they'll reach out to us and let us know, because there's lots of good college TV and college books. There's Community. People would want us to mention Community.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, when we come back, we will be at our favorite part of the show every week, what is making us happy. So we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Ashley, and I'm calling from Springfield, Missouri. And now we'd like to thank one of our sponsors who helped make today's program possible, Oyster. Oyster would like you to know about their app, where you can subscribe to read as many books as you'd like for a monthly fee. With over 1 million titles in every genre, from Harry Potter to The Goldfinch, Oyster allows you to discover great literature. It's designed to feel personal, with editors' book picks, unique reader themes, and recommendations based on what you like. For a free 30-day trial to Oyster Unlimited, visit oysterbooks.com/NPR. Thank you.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
I've got a Tumblr and a new album, and they are somehow cousins, even though they're in many ways completely unrelated. My sister last year, I think, sent me a link to this wonderful Tumblr that I read, loved, and promptly forgot about that I recently rediscovered called Here's That Bad Advice You Were Hoping For. And it's on Tumblr at thatbadadvice.tumblr.com. Tumblr.com. She's taking letters out of advice columns and giving them more direct answers. And it's very, very, very funny.
I love that.
It takes the form often of rants that boil down to mind your nosy beeswax or shut your judgy pie hole. And with a big heaping dollop of feminism to top it all off, it's withering sarcasm, beautifully worded and therapeutic to read. Each entry is kind of distilling the letter down to what it really boils down to. So it's things like, help, my sister took in my child for a year and fed them processed food. Do I have to settle for a wife with an 8-megapixel camera? Help, my neighbors have different ideas about how parenting works. There's one recently where it's basically this guy complaining about, like, I'm an average-looking guy, and it seems like my choices when it comes down to women are the following kinds of women. And then is there another option other than becoming rich and famous? And so her response, which I will excerpt here, she basically, her advice is, no, become rich and famous. How else will you ever obtain a human body that will offer you all the features you require in a mate? All rich and famous men of middling attractiveness are swarmed with the latest top-notch releases of human women, and none experience unhappiness in their romantic relationships.
Nice.
This is simply how the marketplace works. Men earn human women through fame and fortune, since human women are the automatic reward that men earn from being financially successful.
Wow.
You've already done the hardest part, comparing the currently available varieties of human woman and narrowing down the options to the model that works best for your needs. It's wonderful, wonderful writing that, like I said, boils down largely to mind your nosy beeswax, shut your judgy pie hole, which leads me into the album I've been listening to, which is the new, I believe as yet untitled, second album by the country singer Kacey Musgraves, whom I love and who specializes in writing anthems about minding your nosy beeswax and shutting your judgy pie hole.
Nice.
The record's coming out, I think, in like May or June or something like that, but the first single is already out. It's wonderful. It's right in that family of like Follow Your Arrow and these anthems that she writes about just like shutting out what other people have to say about you. The first single is called Biscuits.
Just hold your own road.
It's such a tidy,
it
beautiful,
is tiny.
So sweetly catchy. She's just dynamite. She is our foremost practitioner of the Shut Your Judgy Pie Hole anthem, and I just love her, Kacey Musgraves.
Thank you Excellent. Very much, mm-hmm. Stephen Thompson. Cat Chow, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I like that food stuff in there. but what's making me happy is a book by Angela Forney, The Turner House, which is just absolutely beautiful. It recently dropped, and it's basically about this intergenerational family in Detroit. And there's something about Angela's writing that's just absolutely gorgeous, and I recommend it to everybody. If you can, go pick up a copy and read it, because it's what's making me happy.
What's it called again?
The Turner House.
Thank you very much, Kat Chow. Jean Demby, what's making you happy this week?
What's making me happy, actually, is when I first started blogging years and years and years ago, there was this blog called Edge of the American West, and it was managed by two historians who were then at UC Davis, I believe. One of them is this guy named Ari Kelman, who I've sort of stayed in touch with over the many years since he is now at Penn State. He has this graphic novel called Battle Lines. It's really beautiful, gorgeous graphic novel about the Civil War. He's sort of like lovely, evocative, and harrowing graphic novel about the war that like rent our nation asunder. And there's so many, obviously a million books about the Civil War out there, and some of them are obviously like canonical, but this manages to be both like sober and giving you a sense of scale without seeming inaccessible and like portentous and important.
Mm-hmm.
So, let the record show that Gene puffed out his chest.
Yeah, exactly. I would recommend this book highly, Battle Lines by Ari Kelman. Nice.
Thank you yeah. very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jean Demby. I am just back from New York, where I did two things. First, I did attend the International Championships of Collegiate Acapella,
yes.
which were amazing. I'm doing some more work on that, so stay tuned as far as that goes. The other thing is I was up there for the Tribeca Film Festival, and I saw some really interesting stuff. In addition to the National Lampoon documentary, there's a surprisingly interesting Saturday Night Live documentary. I say that just because that show has been dissected to such a degree that I'm always surprised when anyone finds anything new to say about it. Mm-hmm. But I think that documentary, which is called Live from New York, does have some new things to say. I also saw some narrative films. I saw a film called Slow West, which was at Sundance, and I believe is available on demand through DirecTV. Slow West features Michael Fassbender as a cowboy who creates a kind of a loose alliance with a younger guy who is looking for the girl that he loves. And they are in the kind of the traditional vision of the American West. The tone to me is very Coen Brothers. It's not a Coen Brothers movie, but it feels in many ways very much like their True Grit to me. So I saw that and really liked it. I saw a movie called Hungry Hearts that features Adam Driver and a young actress whose name I'm unfortunately not going to remember. They play a couple that has a baby, and she becomes one of these moms who is really convinced that everything is bad for the baby, and she doesn't trust doctors, and she doesn't want to give the baby, she wants to raise the baby vegan. And this all starts off as this story of her just being nervous and anxious and him not really knowing how to respond to that. And it evolves into a film that has some sort of horror elements, but also a bunch of really thoughtful stuff about parenting and how creepy, scary it would be to find yourself parenting with someone who you couldn't kind of connect with anymore. It's a really creepy movie, and I enjoyed it a great deal. I also saw a movie by Neil LaBute, who did In the Company of Men and a bunch of other sometimes very nihilistic work, who's a playwright. And so when you see his stuff, it's very dialogue dependent. He's very into very playful ways of writing dialogue, which, you know, when you've seen a lot of stuff that's experimental in form, somebody who is primarily interested in writing conversations between people can be really cool. The movie is called Dirty Weekend, and it features Matthew Broderick and Alice Eve as colleagues who get stranded in Albuquerque. And if I tried to explain what happens in this movie after they get stranded in Albuquerque, go into this movie knowing as little as possible about it, because it really is extremely interesting. They are not a romantic couple. That is not where this movie is going. But it is a movie that is very much about relationships and sex and stuff like that. And it's, I thought it was a really cool and interesting little film. Dirty Weekend by Neil LaBute. Oh, and also, I got to see Mary J. Blige.
Nice.
Because I saw a new...
You buried the lead.
The documentary itself is mostly... It's a documentary by her record company. Yeah. So the documentary is what it is. The album's great, but then she performed. I went with our old pal, Mike Katziff.
Nice.
That was pretty cool. So absolutely. Those things are all making me very happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow the show at NPRPCHH. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Kat at Kat Chow, like the name of the television show and newspaper column. That's KATCHOW. You can follow Gene at GD215. That's GEEDEE 215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, REEDY, and our producer, Emeritus and Music Director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks so much to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We're also interested in listening to you, so let us know what you think of this and other NPR podcasts by joining NPR Listens. Tell us what you love and what you love less. Speak up now at nprlistens.org.